Our reporter, Ellen Morgan, explains how Baroness Varsi went from being one of the Conservative Party's biggest assets to one of its fiercest critics.
Saeeda Varsi has spent her political career fighting Islamophobia, rising to hold a prominent platform within the Conservative Party.
It's 20 years since
a lawyer with the Crown Prosecution Service, in 2007 she was made a member of the House of Lords, specifically to deal with community cohesion. When the Conservatives got into power under David Cameron in 2010, she became Britain's first Muslim female member of the cabinet. She was Minister for Communities and Faith before moving to the Foreign Office to lead government policy on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. But she resigned from Cameron's government over its support of Israel in the 2014 Gaza War. Since then, she's become increasingly critical of her own party and called on then Prime Minister Theresa May to investigate Islamophobia within the Conservatives. In 2019, all five candidates in the Conservative leadership contest, including future Prime Minister Boris Johnson, committed to an independent inquiry into Islamophobia within the party. 2 years later, that inquiry found anti-Muslim sentiment was a persisting problem within the party. But it also said there was no evidence that the Conservatives treated complaints about Islamophobia differently from other types of discrimination. Since then, Baroness Varsi has called out what she sees as high-profile cases of Islamophobia playing out in policy. For example, the case of Shamima Begum, who flew to Syria as a schoolgirl to join Daesh, also known as ISIS. The government stripped Begum of her citizenship, a decision overseen by then-Home Secretary Sajid Javid. The Baroness criticised that move, saying it was against British values of fairness.
Visit gov.uk/prevent.
She's also been critical of the government's Prevent scheme, which encouraged community members to report any suspicious activity, aiming to put a stop to radicalisation. And she continues to be one of the key voices wanting to bring unity to the party.
The fog of fascism is once again spreading across our continent. How Britain responds to this new environment will determine whether we succeed in remaining a tolerant, diverse, liberal, inclusive democracy.
And I'm now joined here in the studio by Baroness Varsi. Welcome to Westminster Watch. So, look, in 2005, you stood as a candidate for the Conservative Party in the general election. So let me begin your journey. Why politics and why the Conservative Party for you?
I think I've always been political. So going right back to my student days when I was vice president of the Students' Union.
Was your family political?
So my dad worked in the mills and was part of the trade union movement. And my mum, for as long as I could remember, voted Margaret Thatcher. So there was always political conversation around the table. And being part of the political process is something that we absolutely grew up with. But I think party politics for me came much later. I was very much an issues-based politician. And when party politics came to the fore, I realised that when I took a long, hard look at the way I wanted to live my life and the way I was living my life, then I was genuinely a Conservative, which, of course, Mum was incredibly pleased about. I'm not so sure.
But did you look around and think, well, this is what these parties stand for, so actually I'm a Conservative? And was that hard, in a way? Were you going against the grain of your generation and where you lived?
I was, because most people from my kind of background, working class, ethnic minority, voted for the Labour Party. But then I'd always grown up with Mum voting Conservative. So I think there'd been a split there very early on. But I also think that when we looked at things like wanting a world in which you could make decisions for yourself, where the state didn't particularly intervene in your life, where you believed in family values, small c conservative, you believed in being rewarded for your hard work, for the state getting out of the way and allowing you to flourish for a community that was absolutely an entrepreneurial community. My father, who eventually started a business, I think all of those things really pointed me towards what I felt was a party which said you can actually make your life better, rather than this is where you were meant to be. And I think that's what made me a conservative. Did I agree with everything that the Conservative Party believed in? Of course not. And when I looked at it historically, the ghost of Enoch Powell did hang over the Conservative Party and still does for a very long time. I would be questioned by members of various ethnic minority communities, but also working class communities, to say, how can you be a conservative?
But would it be fair to say Enoch Powell doesn't really represent the Conservative Party? In fact, he was alienated from the party. He never rose to leadership positions.
And that's the point that I keep making now when people say, well, the party has always had this extreme right wing tendency. And I said, well, whenever it's reared its head, the mainstream of the party have managed to isolate it and sideline it. And in many ways, that was the Conservative Party that I served at the forefront of with David Cameron. And he managed to do that. I mean, you know, he made no bones about the fact that he thought, I think his words were something like fruitcake loons and closet racists or something.
He was talking about UKIP at the time.
So I think he had a very clear view of what he thought was not the mainstream of the Conservative Party.
So if I may, you then went into the party and in 2007 you were elevated to the House of Lords and you went on to some pretty significant posts in the party. We'll come to those if I may, but you've also published your book, Muslims Don't Matter, which is a recommended read. And I would say this with a full compliment, an easy read to digest. But goodness me, you start very powerfully and basically say, you are done with apologising. It read to me like there's an angry person writing this. So tell me, is that accurate? Were you angry and why?
I wrote the book earlier this year. I wrote it in 12 weeks. I think being angry allowed me to write it in 12 weeks. I think underneath the anger was also fear. And alongside that fear was heartbreak.
And can you tell me why and what about?
Because I found myself in 2024 looking at the rhetoric in the mainstream of politics, particularly in the Conservative Party, at the way in which I found that the community that I was born and raised in, the British Muslim community, was being demonised and stigmatised and stereotyped, that the way in which headline after headline, even when they're found to be not accurate and they are subsequently corrected, it doesn't stop them, certain aspects of the media, from pumping out what is very clearly anti-Muslim, anti-British Muslim rhetoric. I think there is a clear sense that there are certain communities which are being held in a way where they are disengaged from policymaking. And this started right back in the Blair years, the policy of disengagement, where larger and larger members of the British Muslim community, mainstream political mainstream community organisations, are disengaged from the political process. And it just felt like that for a long time, efforts were made to try and explain or justify or caveat or condemn or whatever those kind of ways
were. And that's what you were done apologising for,
yes,
wasn't it?
So it was a way of saying, let's try and be as acceptable and as palatable to these policymakers who, by the way, have an agenda not to make life easy for British Muslims. And we, at that point, I think earlier this year, I just thought, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how hard you try. It doesn't matter how hard you have served this country. And I talk about my own personal experience, a grandfather, paternal and maternal grandfathers who served in the British Indian Army, a great uncle who was taken prisoner of war, a father who worked in the mill towns in Yorkshire to rebuild this country, as somebody who had served her country at the top table in cabinet, and as a child now back in, you know, I have a child now back in uniform in our armed forces serving this country. And it just felt that even five generations later, nearly 70 years later, however much we served and protected and defended and built and, you know, did what we did for this country, we were still being told by a certain section of the media and politics and the think tank world, you don't belong, you don't matter,
okay,
you're problematic.
But you say then you're at a turning point, effectively. You said it doesn't work, done apologising. And you've been quoted as saying, you know, you're a one-person fighter now. You're a one-lady fighter against Islamophobia. What does that fight look like? What does it mean?
A one woman, I think I'm being called a one woman Islamophobia rebuttal unit. What does that fight look like? I don't know what it looks like, but I know it feels exhausting. It feels like what for me as a lawyer seemed obvious, you know, present the evidence, present the facts, present the stats. And of course, policymakers will take this on board. But the level of bad faith in policymaking, I think, is what shocked me. That in a way, for somebody who grew up where racism was so much more overt, I mean, this term, insulting term, paki bashing was used, where you would be physically assaulted in the street. That in some ways that was easier to deal with. You knew what you were dealing with. It was immediate. It was ignorant. It was, it was painful. But the kind of pernicious form of racism, this Islamophobia that I found.
And eating into policy.
Eating into policy in the corridors of power.
Can you give me an example?
Of course. You know, everything from the way in which the disengagement process has been dealt with. More recently, the Shamima Begum case. Here we ended up with a situation where whether Shamima Begum is a saint or a sinner, she's our saint or sinner. She was born here. She was raised here. She's held no nationality other than a British nationality. They've stripped her of a citizenship and effectively made her stateless. We've now created two classes of citizenship. A class A of people whose heritage is effectively essentially white, and a class B of all these people from various countries who have been here now for four or five generations, and before that, by the way, lived within the British Empire. So their relationship with Britain goes back hundreds of years, who are now class B citizens.
Can I ask you, you rose, as I mentioned, in your career, you rose to some of the highest posts in government. You were chairman of the Conservative Party. You were in the Foreign Office. You were Minister of Faith and Communities. That's top table stuff. And that was up until 2014 when you resigned on a matter of principle from the Cabinet. Why was it you were not able to shape and change things from within government that you were obviously acutely aware of that led to this Islamophobia in policymaking?
Yeah, I think much of my fights within government were actually documented at the time because many of them in some way were leaked. And they're also documented in detail in my first book. So there is no doubt that my time in government, my four or five years in cabinet, were fraught with constant fights on these issues.
What was it that stopped them listening to you? They put you on this pedestal. You were the first woman Muslim cabinet member. Are you just saying that's it, you were window dressing?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, and there were some battles, certainly in the early times, with, I think, the support of the Liberal Democrats, which meant that we did manage to have some early wins. But some of the kind of more pernicious stuff around making prevent, for example, putting it on a statutory basis and putting this aspect of our counterterrorism strategy in the heart of schooling, where effectively we've had thousands of referrals of British Muslim children to this process, which have subsequently turned out to be completely without any basis. And the stigmatizing of a whole community and the silencing of a whole community and a whole generation through that process, that was only brought in on a statutory basis once I resigned. But some of the work that we did around community cohesion, I see as a huge win. Some of the work that we did around making sure that our police forces were properly disaggregating and recording hate crimes according to religious categories was a win. Setting up the cross-government working group on anti-Muslim hatred, trying to create, really not reinventing the wheel, but looking at the great work that had been done within government on anti-Semitism and replicating some of that on Islamophobia was all a success. But then, unfortunately, much of that was dismantled. You know, in the post-Cameron years, much of that work has now either been ground to a halt or has been taken apart. And so I think the wins that we did get early on
have been reversed.
Were then pushed back.
But in 2007, as I say, you'd been in the House of Lords. You are still a member of the House of Lords, of course. Your thoughts about rowing back some of the introductions and advances that you made are one thing. Why now, though, have you resigned the whip in Parliament, in the House of Lords? What's driven you to do that?
I think it's on a very specific issue, and the very specific issue is that having worked with the party since 2000 and, well, over a decade now in terms of bringing to their attention the pernicious form of racism, Islamophobia within the Conservative Party, they have had case after case after case submitted to them from, you know, the voluntary party, the parliamentary party, real examples of our members of parliament still in parliament who have hosted extremists at the heart of parliament, anti-Muslim extremists at the heart of parliament, and no action was taken. And the fact that we just seem to kind of have a laissez-faire approach to anti-Muslim racism.
But you've stayed with the political party. You are still a member of the Conservative Party. Yet your own Conservative Party, they're being ignored, according to you, with these incidents of Islamophobia that have been reported. So, you know, the party run from London, the headquarters, the political party, you're still a member of it that's doing nothing about reports that have come from voluntary members. Why are you still a party member?
I think this is a big dilemma for me. It's a question I ask myself consistently. You know, do you stay and fight, or do you just say that I'm done with fighting these guys now? And I think when I look and think back to the time when I sat around the cabinet table, I refuse to accept that what I see in the party right now is what it's become and then what it will always be. There has to be hope that we can take it back to a sensible centre ground. Some would say that by making my life as difficult as the party chooses to do is trying to push me out. And it may well be that that's where this all ends, right?
Do you think they are trying to push you out? Because there is an issue between you and the party at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's completely politically motivated, and as each day goes by, it becomes more apparent.
And yet, you still want to stay with this party?
Yeah, it's not their party. So the people who are choosing to fight these battles, the people who are poisoning the space so that British Muslims feel it increasingly difficult to be within the Conservative Party, it's not their party. The Conservative Party is a broad church, and at different times, different sections of it have been at the helm. And if you choose to accept that those that are at its helm now are effectively the party as it will now be forever, then I think that's a really kind of disheartening approach.
Well, that brings me to the obvious question. Do you think the party that you knew is going to be able to return under the leadership of Kemi Badenoch?
I think that early indications show that Kemi is not going to step away from fighting her culture wars anytime soon. I mean, it astonished me that in her first PMQs, she chose to ask her first question in defence of Donald Trump. You know, here is a man who is a misogynist.
But to be fair, wouldn't it be odd on the day that he won the election with an overwhelming mandate for the leader of the opposition not to ask about Donald Trump might have seemed a bit daft?
I don't think that the question she asked was in relation to Britain's future relationship. I think it was a specific culture war political question. And I think that when it comes to Britain's national interest and Britain's long-term relationship with the United States, an important ally, I don't think it's one that we should be making party political hay over.
Many would say the Conservative Party is actually a progressive party. You were its first woman Muslim cabinet member. Sajid Javid went to one of the highest offices in the land. You got Kemi Badenoch, a black leader. You had Rishi Sunak. I mean, most people would say this is a progressive party. Do you think it is?
I think this is a party that has definitely had many firsts. I mean, going right back to Margaret Thatcher. But the one thing I think that we all agree on is that just because the late Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister, we didn't deal with the issue of misogyny and violence against women. Just because we ended up with myself as the first Muslim in cabinet didn't mean that we dealt with the issue of Islamophobia. We've had, Jewish leaders in the past of the Conservative Party. It doesn't mean that there's no such thing as anti-Semitism in the United Kingdom. So I think it's really important for us to, one, you know, go back to what the facts say around these communities, not individuals, but about communities as a whole. But secondly, acknowledge that diversity is more than skin deep. Diversity is more than having people of different colour around the table. Diversity has to also have inclusion by its side. And where you end up with politicians of colour who actually don't progress these matters on equality, but in some cases choose to pander to racism and punch down against the very communities that they come from or
think,
other
communities. Do you think
communities.
Conservative leaders have been
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. We have had members of the ethnic minority community who have served in cabinet who have pandered and punched down. And I think that we absolutely need to call out those people who, you know, are prepared to hide behind their race or their colour. I named them in the book. You know, I talked very openly about how I felt that, you know, Sajid Javid, who I've known for many years and as an individual, you know, have a lot of time for, but I think his time in office was deeply flawed in the way that he dealt with both the issues of the grooming gangs and the issue of Shamima Begum.
Let me ask you.
I think it's a terrible decision that he made, and I think history will judge him harshly for it.
Let me ask you this, though, because it is interesting, this sort of dichotomy of that you resigned on the cabinet in principle and then you've resigned the Conservative whip in the Lords, but you're still a member of the party. If a young Muslim, a young Muslim woman is watching this, perhaps thinking of becoming an MP, would you recommend becoming an MP to her? And would you recommend that she should join the Conservative Party?
Yes and yes. And the reason why I say that is because I go back to that Yorkshire stubbornness, which says it's not their party. And if you stand back and allow people to push you out of their spaces because they want voices like yours to be pushed out of their spaces, that's when they genuinely win. And so if you're genuinely going to fight what I call these axes of influence, where the space for British Muslims, not just in politics, but in other spaces as well, is being closed down, the way you deal with that is to grow a really thick skin and push back. Now, you know, this last year has been so difficult when I have received phone call after phone call from the most senior members of, you know, the bar, the judiciary, the, you know, the medical profession, healthcare workers, people in the city, British Muslims who have felt silenced in their workplace.
Perhaps you can tell me something, a final question for you. Try and explain, if you like, to this white Christian man what it's like to wake up, and I definitely have the impression this is what you do, to wake up every morning and have to think about racism, which is something I don't do.
Yeah. It's exhausting and it's heartbreaking. And it's, you know, the moment you open your emails, the moment you open your social networks, it's there. Sometimes it's offensive. Sometimes it's ignorant. And then sometimes it's just when you travel on the tube, you just step back a few steps and you make sure you don't stand on the edge of the platform. You're just a little bit careful. You look over your shoulder a little bit more. You overhear conversations and then you move seats sometimes in a train because you think, I don't want to hear the rest of that conversation. I don't want to be involved in it. Somebody asked me recently, he said, do you think that sometimes people look at you and think, why is she going on about this again? Why is she going on about anti-Muslim racism again? And I said, you know, don't you think that they don't want to hear it anymore? And I said, don't you think I don't want to talk about it anymore? You know, this is at my age, I'm now 53. I'm at that stage where the kids, you know, we have wonderful kids who have all moved out. We're empty nesters and we have been successful social mobility, you know, stories, both my husband and I. And this should be the time when we should actually just be able to enjoy our life and look at what's coming ahead. But instead, what we think about when we look ahead is, will our children choose to make this their home forever, make Britain their home forever? Will our grandchildren make Britain their home? And that is a really fearful place to go into. And when I hear my siblings and I hear my close friends talking about exit routes and plan Bs and buying homes elsewhere in the world in case it gets too much, I do wake up every morning and think, God, it would be great to be a white, English, Christian man. But that's not the way I was born, and that's why I've got to keep fighting.
Baroness Varsi, thank you very much for joining us here on Westminster Watch.
Thank you.